Hi, I'm Pat Kelly.
And I'm Peter Oldring, and we're the hosts of This Is That.
Are you kidding?
For over a decade, we were radio's go-to source for completely fabricated news.
You must be joking me.
And now, we're back in podcast form.
We've selected some of our favorite stories from over the years and put them in one convenient location.
Sugar in the tap water.
Bilingual dog park. Charging to see wildlife.
This Is That, coming soon on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
When you send a famous politician to the Met Gala, one of the fanciest, celebrityest events of the year, wearing a dress that says "Tax the Rich," you're going to get people talking. For Canadian fashion designer Aurora James, getting people talking is kind of her thing. But it doesn't just stop there. Aurora uses her influence to make real change. That includes paying artisans a living wage and putting pressure on major retailers to stock more Black-owned businesses. Coming up, Aurora talks about her new memoir, Wildflower, and her roots, both in activism and fashion. Plus, Ocean Vuong's second poetry collection, Time is a Mother, was an instant New York Times bestseller. Now it's been shortlisted for the 2023 Griffin Poetry Prize. Ocean shares how the loss of his mother inspired this new collection and why he calls death the truest thing. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You are listening to Q. If you're skeptical about whether one person can change the world, consider the story of Aurora James. She's a Canadian fashion designer. Her memoir, Wildflower, comes out tomorrow. In it, she writes about surviving childhood abuse, dropping out of high school, getting arrested, and getting out of jail, and then eventually becoming a really influential voice in fashion. Beyonce, Rihanna, and Meghan Markle are all fans of her label, Brother Velly's. 3 years ago, Tom Power spoke to Aurora about something called the 15% Pledge. It convinced major retailers to stock more products from Black-owned businesses. I'm talking huge corporations like Sephora, The Gap, and Indigo. Aurora James changed the way they do business. That is not easy. Tom spoke to Aurora about her new memoir, Wildflower, and her journey with fashion.
How are you?
I'm so good, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to unpack some of this with you today.
Right, me too. I mean, right off the bat, Aurora, I mean, I think one of the first lines in the whole thing is, this is not a success story. At least it shouldn't be told that way. Talk to me about that. What's wrong with being seen as a success story?
I think so often with memoirs and like the success stories, especially that we read about young women these days, is it's almost like this bar that everyone else is expected to hold themselves up to, right? Like, I kind of grew up in the girl boss era where people were breaking glass ceilings and doing all these things, and the expectations just seemed like really unrealistic. And also, like, everything is a work in progress, right? And I think that this book really articulates how much of a work in progress I am as well. And so I think labeling it a success story feels like really finite, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing because the I think for people who would only know you through, say, fashion magazines, people who would know you from reading Vogue or something like that, might be surprised by some of the stories that you tell in this book. Talk to me maybe about sharing some of the messier or more complicated parts of your life here.
Yeah, I think fashion is so notorious for being buttoned up, you know, no pun intended. It's like everyone really has to keep their like a costume of identity on straight at all times. And I think it does a disservice to not only like the industry, but also all of the young people who kind of aspire to work in fashion or take their own sense of self-worth or value from the people that they see in the media, whether it's models or celebrities or anything like that, right? And I think for me, as horribly uncomfortable as it was to tell some of these stories and continues to be, I just think that we have to normalize like the cuts and scrapes and bruises that we get along our own journey, right? Because if we hide all of those, it just makes people continue to feel less than for the things that actually make them great.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I mean, and again, only as much as you want to hear about some of this. So you write in the book about growing up with a very, very abusive, I mean, stepfather. I mean, there were moments it was really challenging to read. I mean, much less, I'm sure, live through. And then as a teenager, your frustration with your home life comes out in a few different ways. Tell me a little bit about the more sort of rebellious things you were sort of going through. Because I was sort of taken aback by, you know, dropping out of high school and trafficking drugs and racing cars and going to jail. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think for me, with the driving, the racing cars and all of that, I think it was a form of depression, right? I think I was just dying to try to feel something, anything. And maybe playing with my own mortality a little bit, right? I think, you know, selling drugs is really fascinating because it's a thing that so many people turn to, especially people of color, when they don't feel like they have a lot of options. And even myself coming from like a fairly privileged background, right? Like ending up in a situation where that was actually the thing that was around me and sort of the easiest to monetize really quickly is sort of fascinating, sort of disturbing, right? And even dropping out of high school, I mean, I remember sitting in history class and the teacher talking to me about parts of American history. And, you know, my mom's voice kind of played in my head with this Nigerian proverb that she always told me, which was, until the lion has a historian, the hunter will always be the hero. And as, you know, strange of a thought as it was for me to have when I was 17, I just thought, like, what kind of damage am I doing to myself by continuing to allow these narratives that are potentially untrue to be forced into my head in this way? And that was sort of what led me to leave.
Yeah. I mean, these were all tremendously challenging things to go through. I mean, like I said, the racing cars, like speeding away from a police officer after you got pulled over, all of these things. But no matter how bad things kind of got and no matter how bad things were at home, you write in the book about taking comfort in just strolling around the mall and looking at clothes. What's your earliest memory of falling in love with fashion?
Wow. I think it was also even in my mom's closet, right? Just looking at the different colors and textures and flipping through fashion magazines, and, you know, watching fashion television on TV with Jeannie Becker and also Tim Blanks and all these amazing, you know, Canada has this very special way actually of embracing fashion. And I remember always watching fashion shows on television, which was really amazing. And it just felt like this very special art form that you could intimately engage with on your body. And you could use it as a tool to speak about yourself and what you valued and what you loved, whether it was just a concert shirt from your favorite band, or if it was, you know, indigenous apparel and you're an indigenous person, right? Like you can do so much communicating. And I think in a world where I often felt silenced, especially as a child, right? And even in my adolescence as a student, and then, you know, as a woman always, and then as a woman of color, I felt like how I communicated with my clothes was an area where no one could stop me or silence me.
I mean, speaking of fashion television, eventually you get a big break when Jeannie Becker herself helps you get a job at fashion television.
I'm Jeannie Becker. Be here Monday at 9:30 for FTV Fashion Television.
I'd love for you to tell the story about how you two met.
Sure. So I was working at a gym actually in Yorkville while I was in college, and the dress code was all black. And so I would really push the limits of finding these like obscure, like Ann Demulemeister, like Rick Owens, or, you know, these crazy designer thrift shop finds from Kensington Market. And so I'd have these like giant black bows on my collar or something at like 6:30, swiping her in for the gym every day. And she would sort of laugh at me. And then one day she was just like, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm just checking you in. And she was like, no, what are you really doing like with your life? You know? And I was like, I'm doing school to try to get a job with you one day. And so she kind of took me under her wing, and I'm so grateful for that opportunity.
What's the most valuable thing you learned while you were working at fashion television?
Oh, to treat anything that you love with the utmost care. And I think the way in which Jeannie and the whole team at Fashion Television approached fashion really spoke to its value and potential, right? Like, I listen to people all the time be like super dismissive of fashion, especially now after launching my nonprofit. I talk to a lot of business reporters all the time and they're like, don't you also work in fashion? You know, and it's kind of, they're like semi-horrified. And it's sort of like, well, yes. And by the way, it's like one of the largest employers of women around the world and is, you know, $1 trillion industry, and we can change hearts and minds all the time and actually have such a huge impact on things that you don't even realize. So yes, you can be dismissive of fashion, but it's perhaps to your own detriment.
So at Fashion Television, you're saying that you learned sort of like the care that people can put into these things and how much it can mean to people.
Well, Jeannie covered fashion. Like, she would elbow her way backstage into a Marc Jacobs show as though she was a war correspondent, you know, and like get the microphone in front of his face and be like, tell me about, you know, what you're saying on this runway right now. And the seriousness that she had of like getting to that information, to me at the time, I was like, whoa, this is a little bit intense. But she needed to know, right? Because she felt like so much of what we were seeing down the runways was a weather vane for how the country or the world was feeling at that time. And I don't disagree with that.
I mean, let's fast forward a little bit to the moment you kind of step out on your own as a fashion designer and you develop Brother Vellies, your own brand. Around 2011, you were traveling around the African continent. You start noticing the artisans. You start noticing the shoes that they were making. Briefly, can you tell us the concept that you came up with then?
Sure. So I fell very much in love with this shoe called a veli or a veldskoon. And it was one of the very first shoes that originated on the continent. It started out with just being pieces of leather from animals that they had hunted and eaten, being wrapped around the foot. And then it became like three or four pieces tacked together, almost like a moccasin. And then eventually it got a rubber sole and laces. And when British people came to Southern Africa, they saw the shoe, they fell very much in love with it. They brought it back up to the UK and they launched a company that you and I know today as Clarks. Mm. But that desert boot is actually a traditional Southern African shoe shape. And so when I was there, I too fell in love with it. And I started kind of visiting a bunch of different workshops that had a history of making these shoes. And I would show up at places only to find out that they were closed and had closed years before. And I realized that it was because there wasn't any work. Partially because American and Canadian donated clothing and shoes and all of that was just like killing out the local manufacturing industries. And, you know, I decided to take my entire life savings at the time, Tom, which was only $3,500, mm-hmm. and make a batch of shoes with them. And I kind of tweaked the colors and the shape a little bit and, you know, met with a bunch of different artisans that were there. The Himba women like helped me figure out red dye, which was utilizing the ochre paste that they cover their bodies with. And you know, that was sort of how the first ever Brother Vellies collection was kind of inadvertently born.
I mean, and then you start selling the shoes at like small markets in New York City. And then pretty quickly, you're in the New York Times style section. Meghan Markle's blog does a write-up on you. The artist Micheline Thomas becomes a fan. When did you know that things were starting to roll in a way maybe you couldn't have anticipated?
You know, like, I think that I've always had different barometers of what success means with this company. I think for me, it was about how do we actually involve artisan communities around the world in the fashion conversation instead of just having them be on mood boards, right? And how do we engage consumers to start thinking about how they can shop differently, right? And actually be able to shop with their values. And so I started seeing success there, I would say in the first 2-3 years, I think getting into the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund and having lots of conversations with, you know, some of the most influential people in the fashion industry about what it means to be not just a designer, but also an activist, was really when I think the sea change sort of happened there.
Right. But at the same time, you were launching Brother Valleys. At the same time, you were sort of getting that advice from and encouragement from some people in the fashion industry, as you mentioned, like some of the more important people in the fashion industry. You also got a lot of industry advice warning you not to partner with artisans on the African continent. Why did they think this mission was impossible? Why were they warning you against it?
You know, I think it's really hard to like scale a business with like that kind of material sourcing, and the profit margins are so thin when you're trying to make things all the time. And it really hadn't been done so much before. I mean, there was another brand called Eden, which was started by Bono and acquired by LVMH. And he had made this statement like maybe the year that I started, where he was like, well, African production is really not possible. So everyone was sort of like, Aurora, like if LVMH and Bono can't do it, like why are you trying, kind of thing. But to go back to like what success means, I think for me, it wasn't that I needed to create a business that was going to be the size of Michael Kors. So I think I've, you know, defined success a little bit differently for myself, which is partially why heeding their advice didn't make sense to me at the time.
How did you define success for yourself?
I think I wanted to keep some of these artisans employed, for one. And two, I think just tell the story about Valleys, right? And share them with people that I thought would care in the same way that I cared. You know, they were an incredible shoe. And I think also so much of what I was seeing in Africa, just in terms of like their artisanal talent, was also on par with, you know, the couturiers like in Paris. And it's like, okay, so why do we value this one set of hands over another set of hands? You know, and when I ended up going on to win the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund, in this speech, I really kind of accepted the award on behalf of the artisans that I was working with around the world. And I encouraged, you know, my peers in the room, which were some huge designers, to really think a little bit differently about their supply chain. And for all intents and purposes, I really think they have. That's successful to me.
Yeah. The sort of big picture pushback is kind of the first thing I asked you about. You know, people were talking to you about, you know, is this sustainable? Can you do this? Is this even doable? And you also, but you write in the memoir really powerfully about how there were a lot of microaggressions against your brand as well, especially from buyers in the fashion industry in those days. What kind of assumptions did you get about your brand?
I think, you know, just on the consumer side, people used to email me all the time and say like, hey, just saw your website, want to make sure this isn't a Nigerian scam.
No.
Which was crazy. Oh yeah. I would get that email maybe every 3 days from someone. They would literally be like, I saw your website in the New York Times, but just want to make sure this isn't a Nigerian scam.
Wow.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, a magazine or something would feature the shoes. And then the comment section would be like, okay, these shoes are made in Africa, so why are they $300? Aren't people there getting paid like 15 cents a day? It was stuff like that that was super disheartening, you know? And then, you know, I think I go on later to talk about, you know, Nasty Gal and some of the crazy assumptions that even when people are sort of trying to support in a way, like their own unconscious biases kind of flare up.
Yeah, that was when Nasty Gal, who's a kind of a popular brand, they accused the African artisans of shipping shoes with bugs, right?
Right. I mean, that was totally insane. And there would be also what would happen all the time. People would refer to the brand as being like urban or streetwear. And it's like, there's nothing about these shoes that are streetwear, right? Or even technically like urban, you know, but it's this association with blackness that, you know, you really start seeing things in people where, do they understand the term for what it means, or are they just understanding it as a way to other a certain group of people? It's fascinating.
Another big idea comes to you in 2020. I mean, I think this was the first time you and I spoke on this show. It was you joined the protest after the murder of George Floyd, but you wanted to do something more. We talked about it, but just for people who may have missed it back then, you came up with this proposal and posted it to Instagram. Do you remember what that post said?
Yes, it said, "Here is one thing you can do for us." And it asked major retailers to commit 15% of their shelf space to Black-owned businesses. And I outlined something that I had just written up in the notes section of my phone an hour before then, all of the ways in which the American economic landscape would be shifted if major retailers committed their actual spending dollars to supporting Black-owned businesses versus just making philanthropic donations to charities.
Why do you think that was the idea that came to you?
You know, obviously, I was running my own business at the time, and I was also very obsessed with the data that was coming in. It was like 90% of Black-owned businesses had not had access to the first round of PPP money.
The money that was available for COVID recovery, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Okay. COVID relief.
Yeah.
They didn't get access to the first round of Paycheck Protection Program loans / grants that were given out because most of those were forgivable. And I think at the time they were projecting that 44% of Black-owned businesses would be closing as a result of the pandemic, which was like three times the national average. So I was really seeing that the Black community was getting exponentially hit. And at the same time, you know, I was having all of these retailers and corporations, people that I knew, like reaching out to me being like, how much should we donate and where should we donate the money to? And I was like, interesting. You know, and I really appreciate the sentiment and wanting to help and wanting to do something, but is there something more that we can do, right? Because even in my work with Brother Bellies and echoing what my grandmother used to tell me and my mom as a child, it's like, you can give a man a fish and feed him for a day. You can teach a man a fish and feed him for a lifetime. So what does it look like to actually provide opportunity for people in a moment where things feel like they're crumbling?
How many brands have signed on at this point, and how's it been going?
Oh my gosh. So we're about to come up on our 3-year anniversary, which is really exciting. We've announced 29 pledge takers. They all signed multi-year contracts with us. Nordstrom, for example, is a 10-year contract. It basically means we come in and kind of audit them and work with them and make recommendations every quarter. And through those contractual commitments that we have with these 29 companies, we're now in the process of reallocating over $10 billion of annual revenue to Black-owned businesses, which is super, super exciting.
That is super, super exciting. You're listening to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. That was the first part of Tom's conversation with the Canadian fashion designer, creative director, and activist Aurora James. She's been telling stories from her new memoir, Wildflower, which is out tomorrow. Coming up on the show, the Met Gala is easily the biggest night on the fashion calendar and the most exclusive. Aurora James was actually at this year's event, which was a tribute to Karl Lagerfeld, but it was definitely not her first time at the Met Gala. In 2021, she designed a very famous dress for Democrat politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The two of them knew they were going to be a room with some of the richest people in North America, and Aurora James designed a dress that said "Tax the Rich" on the back. She'll tell you about the huge reaction and fallout to that dress up next.
Hi, I'm Willa Paskin, the host of Decoder Ring, Slate's podcast about cracking cultural mysteries. On Decoder Ring, we dive down rabbit holes and obsessively explore questions hiding in plain sight, like why has slow dancing gone out of style? And when did we all become obsessed with hydration? And where did the word mullet, you know, to describe a hairstyle, come from? That's Decoder Ring, named one of the best podcasts of 2023 by the New York Times. Listen to new episodes every 2 weeks and make sure to follow us so you never miss one.
Fashion at its best sparks conversation. And the dress definitely did that. So mission accomplished. Are there people who are going to be upset? Absolutely.
Oh boy. Yes, the dress definitely did that, as you will hear. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power on Q. Canadian fashion designer Aurora James is on the show today. She is not afraid to call out her own industry, whether it's through her label, Brother Vellies, which is all about paying the artisans who make clothes a fair wage, or her nonprofit called the 15% Pledge, which asks major retailers to stock more products from Black-owned businesses. But the most famous example of Aurora James' activism may just be the 2021 Met Gala. She talks about that moment a lot in her new memoir called Wildflower, which is out tomorrow. Tom Power got her to tell the story.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Met Gala, because as much as you know, you've been known, become known for Brother Vellies and for the 15% Pledge, you've also been known for your work at the Met Gala. You got the opportunity to address the very famous Democrat politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What went through your head when that request came in? Because, you know, up to this point, it's a lot of movie stars and kind of pop stars. What went through your head when that came in?
Yeah, good question. You know, there's always been politicians that have gone, so I wasn't super surprised. I think for me, it was, okay, this is one of the largest fashion stages in the world, right? This is a brilliant woman who has very specific messages that she puts out into the world and very specific ways of thinking, right? And as a designer, I always ask myself, how can I help this person show up as the truest and best version of themselves based on where they're going? And I applied that same line of thinking with the congresswoman and, you know, decided that it made sense for her to bring a message into the room that she really kind of speaks to all the time, because, you know, there's a lot of people in that room that she's been speaking to, you know, directly and indirectly before. And I think, you know, it's important to show up as yourself in every room that you enter.
What was her reaction when you said you wanted to design the dress and have it say tax the rich on the back?
She was excited.
Yeah.
She was excited.
Yeah.
You get the opportunities, and in life we can show up and take risks to try to continue to stand up for what we believe in.
Yeah.
Or we can take the easy road, you know, and just sit at the table and be comfortable. But I think ultimately, when you're a politician and you are given a seat at the table, it's also your responsibility to continue asking tough questions.
Aurora, though, I remember when that came out, it was everywhere, that dress.
Last night, progressive Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez used New York's fashion charity event, the Met Gala, to make a political statement.
She was sporting a white gown that read on the back, "Tax the Rich." And this outfit has drawn mixed reactions from the public for promoting the message at an event that cost more than $30,000 per ticket.
It was the message to the rich white libs who would like nothing more than for you to think that they agree.
Like the backlash and people beginning really, I mean, people being really, really happy and excited and reposting it, and then people being so angry. And I think I had talked to you like just maybe a couple of months, maybe or a year before. And I remember thinking like, Aurora, like, oh my God, this is a massive international news story. What was that like in the middle of all that?
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating, Tom, because to be honest with you, like I wasn't so much thinking about how divisive it would be. I was thinking about, here is a woman who has a very particular stance, and what is the conversation that she wants to have in this room, and how can she show up authentically in a room that people are really not expecting her to be in and not compromise her own values? And I think fashion at its best sparks conversation. And the dress definitely did that, right? You know, Joe Biden was literally on TV the next day talking about, you know, the ultra rich and their contributions. And I think in terms of the congresswoman, like, that's kind of her goal. So mission accomplished. Are there people who are going to be upset? Absolutely. And I think that people get, you know, even more upset when they see two women of color being really brazen and speaking out about things. And, you know, I definitely felt the impact of that for sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, like, as much as you want to talk about here, like, were you comfortable going outside? Were you, I mean, was it overwhelming? Like, you know, I wonder what it's like to be sort of in the middle of that.
Yeah, it was tough. I think, you know, there are people who really, 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 really have a strong dislike for her to almost like a maniacal standpoint. And I think as hard as it got for me, you know, my heart was almost bleeding more for her because I realized just how much she has to endure every single day to continue putting her beliefs out there and fighting for what she believes is right every single day. And, you know, I definitely got death threats and all that jazz, and it was really complicated and hard. But more so, I was just like, goodness, like, how do we continue to expect women and politicians and people, anyone, to be that big of advocates for the things that they believe in if the forces that are that strong that are trying to silence you? That part to me is scary. You can disagree with someone,
yeah,
but not want to kill them, right? And I think in Canada, we do a much better job of having civil disagreements. Right. Like, I mean, growing up, like, we were constantly debating different topics. Right. And for me and the experience that I had growing up in Canada, that was par for the course. Like, my mom would say, if you can't debate your opinion on something in a thoughtful way, right, then how do you even stand behind that opinion? And by the way, you need to be able to go into every single conversation being open to changing your mind.
Yeah.
And I think that exists less in America
now. You see that personally, I mean, firsthand in that moment. You see, oh my God, this is the amount of vitriol that's out there. And this is the amount of vitriol that I'm getting. And this is the amount of vitriol. But I mean, comparatively to the number, the amount of vitriol that this like person I had been working with is getting all the time, in the work that she's doing. I can only imagine, Aurora. I mean, it's an amazing story that's told in this book, and we've only touched on some of it. But, you know, I think when we go back to the very beginning of our conversation, we talked about how turbulent your childhood was, you know, I mean, so much abuse in your family, and then about you trying to find a home or a place in the world and rebelling and trying to, you know, everything we were talking about drugs and about trafficking, about, you know, street racing and stuff like that. I mean, it's pretty amazing to see how it all turned out. So I wanted to know, what do you think, like, that teenage version of yourself would say if you told her that this is how her life was going to unfold, that this is the life she'd be having?
I think that she would find it pretty surreal, but perhaps not that surprising. I think there is this narrative in my life about, you know, advocating for others whenever possible, right? I think that Brother Velies and the 15% pledge, and even dare I say, like, you know, that experience with AOC kind of are about injecting the asks and voices of other people into rooms that aren't used to hearing that ask, right? And I believe that, like, not only are a lot of people underrepresented in the world and in rooms, they've been historically and intentionally excluded, right? And I find myself in a lot of places sort of against all odds. And instead of getting entirely comfortable at a table or in a room, I think that I want to just make sure that we can switch up those tables and those rooms a little bit more. And that doesn't have to be a hostile thing at all. I think it can actually be a really beautiful thing, because I think that at our core, you know, we want to be loving and accepting as humans. And it's just fear that holds us back sometimes.
Aurora James, thank you so much for making the time for us. Congratulations on your book and congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much, Tom. It was so nice being here today.
That was Tom Power's conversation with Aurora James, Canadian fashion designer and activist. Her memoir, Wildflower, is out tomorrow.
Hi, this is Booker T. Jones of Booker T. and the MGs, and you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
You're listening to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. Ocean Vuong burst onto the literary scene in 2016 when his first collection of poetry, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, won the prestigious T.S. Eliot Prize. That is quite an entrance to make. In 2019, his first novel, On Earth, We Are Briefly Gorgeous, was published to huge acclaim, and he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship the same year. Ocean writes about growing up in the northeastern United States as a Vietnamese refugee. He writes about the Vietnam War and the way it impacted his family, and he writes about his complicated love for his mother. It's that last theme, the love and the loss of his mother, that takes up residence in his latest poetry collection. It's called Time is a Mother, and it was an instant New York Times bestseller when it came out last year. Now, it's also one of five books that have made the shortlist for the 2023 Griffin Poetry Prize here in Canada. With a cash prize of $130,000, this is the country's biggest poetry prize, and it's open to works written in or translated into English by Canadian and international poets. Tom Power talked to Ocean Vuong about his new collection.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. It's a deep pleasure.
It's a deep pleasure for me as well. Now, Ocean, before we talk about poetry, I should mention that we're Canadian here, and it's worth mentioning that you make your own or have made your own maple syrup.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. This is my first year, backyard maple syrup. We had about, it must have been over 20 gallons, and we got two bottles out of it. So it's actually very mimetic of poems. You know, you write, you fill up these notebooks, and if you're lucky, you get about 2% of anything good, sweet enough to publish.
That is the loveliest Canadian metaphor for poetry I've ever heard. How is it, by the way? Have you had it on a few pancakes or a few waffles or anything?
Yeah, I try to be very, I try to reserve it as much as possible, just to have the sentimental value of having our own syrup. But I'm not an expert, but I had an expert visit us, and he approves they're all very reserved about their expertise, and so he said, yeah, it's almost professional. I'll take it.
Well, I was reading an interview with you in the New Yorker about this latest poetry collection. The collection is called Time is a Mother, and I noticed you called it your proudest book so far. Tell me a little bit about the collection and why that might be.
I think you never know if anything is good or strong or how people will respond to it, but you only know whether it meets your expectation as a maker. And I think with all of my other books, I felt like, when you grow as an artist, the glass gets bigger. Your glass of water gets bigger. And you try your best to fill it up. And with the other books, I felt like there was more to fill up. But with this one, my techniques, my obsessions, it started to, for the first time in my life, I saw the water tip over the brim, which is kind of an exhilarating thing, but also a really, it's full of grief. It's like, well, is this it? You know, have I caught up with myself? You know, so it's both a celebration, but also a kind of tribulation as well. But I do feel finally proud, which is a strange thing to say, I think, as an artist, because so much of any poet would tell you that this thing gets done through failure. You fail forward.
Has that experience of being finally proud of sort of reaching the tip of the glass, have you found yourself writing less or more since the collection?
Much less. You know, I think the question is, you know, you don't want to repeat yourself. I mean, I tell my students this. I said, you know, if you write a good poem and they're proud of it, I'm proud of them. And I said, well, congratulations. Now it's uphill from here. You know, it's writing a good poem teaches you almost nothing about writing the next good poem. You have to kind of reinvent yourself, not necessarily reinvent the wheel, but you reinvent yourself so that you don't become a sort of carbon copy or a factory of yourself. You know, you don't want to cheapen what you've done. And so that is endlessly difficult. But I think it's okay to stop, you know, so much of our culture is about production, but stopping is work. And I would argue that in our modern age of social media and progress, ever-increasing progress, the work of stopping is hard work. It takes a lot of hard work to stop and stop well.
It reminds me of this conversation I had not that long ago with the singer Katie Lang. You know Katie Lang?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
And Katie Lang said something to me. I asked her, I said, Katie, you know, why you haven't put out anything in a while? You know, are you going to put out anything else anytime soon? And she said, you know, Tom, I'll paraphrase her. She said, you know, I've sort of lived my life, you know, the way I write and the way I create is, you know, waiting for the muse, as they say, waiting for the muse to arrive. And if you're going to live like that, you have to also trust it when it doesn't arrive. And maybe it's time. And maybe acknowledge that it won't.
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite writers said something very similar, Annie Dillard. And somewhere in the mid-aughts, she had an interview on NPR. And she said, everyone was waiting for the announcement. What's going to happen? Is Dillard going to announce a new book? And she said the whole event was for her to say, you know, I think I've finished my work as a writer. And I was a young writer then. I was about in my, you know, early 20s. And I thought that was such an incredible thing to hear, that if I was to be lucky enough to live my creative life to the point where I can stop and be good with it, to be happy with what I've done, not endlessly create more and more, but to get to a point where I can stop and be content, that's the rich life. And I hope I can get there one day, following in Dillard's footsteps.
Well, yeah, my journalistic elbow flex is telling me to ask: are you stopping? Like, is this your way of saying, oh, actually, Tom, I'm going to give it up?
I never saw my career as a writer. Teaching is my career. I can do that until my brain stops working. But, you know, I never felt like, just because you've published one book, that you should or even can write another book. And so every book, I'm going to do that very poet thing and be very dramatic here. But I always felt that every book I've written should and could, it should be, if it's my last, I have to be happy with that. You know, I put everything into it. And I think I grew up in Hartford, going to the Baptist church, and we saw, every week we heard about Noah's Ark. And I think I really, through osmosis, internalized that myth. What do you put into your ark? And you better put all of it, all the good things, because it should survive. It should be the only vessel. And then, of course, I've been lucky enough to find material to make something else. But I never expect it, you know. So right now, I don't expect anything else. But I hope, I'm working, you know. But I just, if it's not good enough for me, I will be happy to stop it. And I don't know what that means and where that is, but it's in my back pocket. And I look forward to when it becomes a meaningful decision.
And there's always maple syrup production.
Yeah, next year I got to get 3 bottles.
you can get another $5 out of that. Well, actually, no, yeah. Maple syrup prices, you could probably get another $40 out of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, about grief, you know. I know in 2019 you lost your mom, and I'm so sorry about that. And I know your mom raised you as a single mother. I think when you open up about grief, and this has been certainly my experience in my own, in this kind of work that I do here on the show, when you open up about like a personal grieving that you've experienced, especially in a creative or artistic way, it opens the door for people to come and talk to you about their own grief, maybe at readings or signings, or even maybe out in the street.
How's that been for you?
It's been very humanizing, which is strange to say. You know, you publish a book, you do interviews, and, you know, there's this idea of yourself becoming a symbol, a hologram. You can call it notability, fame, what have you. And a lot of it is the loss of your humanity. But I think publishing this book, people approach you not, you know, seeing who you are as an author, as a public entity, but as someone who has lost. And I think that, you know, it just reiterates what we've always known to be true. And death is, to me, the truest thing, because all of us are heading in that direction. You know, it's truer than honesty, because honesty you have to work towards, you have to be honest, but death simply is. And to watch people, and I've been both, you know, I guess you can say cursed, but also blessed with watching a handful of people die in front of me. And when you confront that moment, you are confronting this total eternal species-wide phenomena of loss. And then how do you live so that you can, it's funny that we talked about the end of writing, which is very similar to the end of life. How do you live a life so that you get to the end and say, ah, well done, which includes all the failures and all the faults. But how you determine that well done depends on how you consider and perceive the work at hand. And that begins now. You know, in a way, I'm 35, but I think, my goodness, I've wasted so much time trying to live and acquire things, and I didn't do enough work to prepare for a good death.
I'm 35 as well, and I've been struggling with the same thing, Ocean. I know what you mean.
Mm. Yeah.
I will say it allows me great compassion. Sometimes when I'm frustrated with somebody, or I'm struggling with somebody, reminding myself that they are going to die and I am going to die brings me the deepest sense of like love and compassion for them, no matter what.
Yeah. And even when you're frustrated with people who haven't experienced grief, and you say, oh, they haven't passed through the big gate, you know? So of course, everything is dramatic and difficult and big and perhaps even self-centered, but they're on the other side, and they're on their way. And but it changes everything when you pass to the side of loss, and everybody passes alone. You know, you can go collectively, but you experience it as an individual.
I'm so happy to have you here, and I'm so happy you're going to read the bowl for us.
Yes.
Would you mind saying something about it before you do?
I think, you know, there's a subgenre of poems called the Ars Poetica, which is interesting. Poetry is one of the only arts where we have a sort of cottage industry of defending it. you never see people defend dance or stamp collecting, you know.
Yeah, I don't have many musicians on who in the middle of the show go like, you know, music deserves to be listened to. And I go, oh, well, that's fine.
Right. But anyway, I'm leaning into the tradition of poets defending their ilk and their work. And so this is kind of an Ars Poetica, which is, you know, the reason for the art, coming from the Latin. And mine is called The Bull. He stood alone in the backyard, so dark the night purpled around him. I had no choice. I opened the door and stepped out, wind in the branches. He watched me with kerosene blue eyes. What do you want? I asked, forgetting I had no language. He kept breathing to stay alive. I was a boy, which meant I was a murderer of my childhood. And like all murderers, my God was stillness. My God, he was still there, like something prayed for by a man with no mouth. The green-blue lamp swirled in its socket. I didn't want him. I didn't want him to be beautiful. But needing beauty to be more than hurt, gentle enough to want, I reached for him. I reached, not the bowl, but the depths. Not an answer, but an entrance, the shape of an animal, like me.
Ocean Vuong's latest poetry collection is called Time as a Mother. It's one of five books on the shortlist for this year's Griffin Poetry Prize. Ocean, I didn't get a chance to say this. Congratulations on making the shortlist.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a deep honor to be among such a treasure trove of voices.
And thank you so much for joining us today. It's lovely to chance to have the chat with you.
Thank you, Tom. Deep pleasure.
I love hearing poetry read out loud, especially by a voice like that. That is Ocean Vuong. Ocean's latest poetry collection is called Time is a Mother. We've now aired our conversations with the three American finalists for the Griffin Poetry Prize. That's Ada Limon, Roger Reeves, and, as you just heard, Ocean Vuong. Stay tuned next month when Tom Power will talk with the two Canadian poets on the shortlist, Susan Musgrave and Iman Mersal. Looking forward to that. That is it for Q today. Tomorrow, it's a big one. A big one. See what I did there? I didn't even mean to do it, but I did it. Tom Hanks. Tom sits down for a full show interview with Tom Power. He has his first ever full-length novel out. It's called The Making of Another Major Motion Picture Masterpiece. Tom and Tom will talk about it all and walk through Tom Hanks's career from Big to Gump and beyond. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. See you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.